afternoon. We'll be starting today's class in just about one moment. I'm going to continue on the theme of understanding Chumash. Hey Doug, how are you?
Oh, we're holding together, Rabbi. How about yourself?
You're holding together.
It beats the alternative.
What's the alternative?
Falling apart.
Oh, you mean the opposite alternative? I mean, there's many alternatives I can suggest. You know, skiing, having a good steak.
That's true. We're actually doing well.
Good to hear.
How about yourself?
Thank God. I actually just came back. I was listening to a class that Rabbi Chait just gave. And what I'll do is tell you over what I heard. Not the complete share. He went on for about an hour and a half. But it was very interesting. And it's the very theme that we're doing now in terms of understanding Chumash. He actually said something very very much germane to, you know, what we do in terms of Noahide. And that'll be part of what I'll start with, and then we'll move on. So the topic is when Moses had killed the Egyptian, when he saw the Egyptian that was beating the Jew. So that is in Exodus 2:12. So it's chapter 2, verse 12. Okay, Rosora, good to see you. And JHS, good to see you as well. Okay, so we're discussing Exodus 2, verse 12. So it said before that Moses had grown up, and he went out to his brothers, and he saw their degraded state, and the labor, the intense labor that they had, and he saw one Egyptian specifically that was beating a specific Jew. Okay. So it says in verse 12, that that Moses looked this way and that way, and he saw that there wasn't any man, so he hit the Egyptian and he killed him, and he buried him in the sand. Okay, so that's the verse that we're going on. So the simple explanation is that he looked around, made sure that nobody would see what he was doing. He saw that the person was worthy of being killed. So he killed him, and he buried him in the sand, and he was doing an act of righteousness to save the Jew. So the problems come in terms of the commentators. And Rabbi Chait had quoted Rashi and Yonason ben Uziel, Jonathan ben Uziel, and also the Yerushalmi. And they all share the same concept. And it says there, what does it mean that Moses looked both ways to see if there was anybody around? That's just a plain literal meaning, which of course has to make sense. But they want to give a midrashic explanation that at first says he saw what he did in his house and what he did in the field, meaning he saw the Egyptian. And what was it that he saw? It wasn't literally that. I mean, of course, the literal makes sense, and that has to be the first and foremost. But as Rabbi Sheikh concluded the class that he gave today, he said that this simple explanation is really just the is not where you're supposed to. That's not the ultimate goal of Torah. The Torah was given to be deciphered, and there's many facets to it. And that's what the rabbis have license to do, is to see certain subtleties and to see certain ideas and to see that there's a sequence in terms of the order of the parts, the order of the sections, and to try to make sense out of what the sequence is. So what they do is they write down certain midrashim, which mean that they are not derived from the literal word, but it's from certain nuances in the word, or certain ideas that they see openings in the text in order to elaborate. And they said, when it says that Moses looked this way and that way, that could also be meant that Moses looked at what this man did in his house and what this Egyptian man did in the field. So what does that mean? Okay. And then it says in the next Rashi, and he saw that there was no man. So Rashi says that he saw that in the future there would be no person from him that would convert to Judaism. So that again is going off of the literal reading. So he saw that the person was evil. But then Moses didn't want to kill him without making sure that he wasn't cutting off a bloodline to certain people in the future that might be good. And this is what Yonason ben Zeal says as well. It says that Moses looked with his wisdom of his mind, and he pondered all the generations. And he saw that there would not be established any man from this Egyptian that would convert, and not one man that would do repentance from all of his descendants forever. So therefore he hid him and he buried him in the sand. So again, you have this concept about looking into the future. So what does this mean? Of course, is the basic question. Rabbi Chait also asked, what is the justice to say that if this guy, this Egyptian, required to be killed, so you kill him? I mean, that's what you do. What do we care about the future? What type of justice system is there that because the guy requires to be killed, but since somebody in the future is going to be good, so therefore we won't kill them? I mean, what is that? That's a very powerful question. And also he asked on this quote of Yonason ben Aziel, he asked, what does it mean? Two things he says. He said that Moses looked into the future, and he also said he pondered with his mind. So if a person sees prophecy, so he just sees it. What's this concept of having to ponder it also and to think into it? That would seem to be against what we think prophecy is. Prophecy, you see the facts and that's it. There's nothing really to think about. That was one part of his question on Yonason ben Aziel. And he also asked, what does he mean to say that that Moses saw two things, that nobody would convert and nobody would do repentance? So he said a very good question. He says the person is noachide, has no obligation to convert. So Rabbi Chaya explained that he understands why he says that Moses saw that there would be nobody who would repent, nobody would be a proper individual. But what's the difference whether nobody converts? I mean, that's not an obligation. So Rabbi Chaya wanted to say on that point that you see from here that Yonason ben Aziel says two things. He said that Moses didn't see anybody who is going to do repentance, but he also didn't see anybody who was going to convert, means to say that although conversion is not obligatory, but he says that a Noahide that sees the ideas and converts is definitely going to be completing his nature as a human being, meaning the completion as a human being is not actualized without conversion. Meaning to say that since, and this makes a lot of sense what we've been saying this whole year, that there's no difference between a person born to Jewish parents or a person born to non-Jewish parents. Now if that's the case, That means the potential for both human beings is identical. And this is barring any type of limitations, because you have limitations within Gentile people, and you have limitations within Jewish people too. You have people that are retarded that are both born to Jewish and Gentile parents. So we're not talking about that. We're not talking about the fact that there are, you have great minds like Aristotle that are Gentile, and you have like Maimonides. And so there's no monopoly that any one group of people, and the groups themselves are really just fabrications of our mind, because everybody comes from Adam and Eve. So we're all the same group of human beings. There's no, you know, you can't separate human beings because of the philosophies that they accept. One accepts Judaism, one doesn't. But Rabbi Chaim's point was a very good deduction. And the fact that Yonos ben Gazil said that Moses saw that nobody of this Egyptian, this evil Egyptian, would repent and live the right life, and also nobody would convert, that means conversion is a good thing, even for a non-Jew, meaning it is a step. It's not just something which is optional. Rabbi Chaim was saying that it really is something which completes the person. And I'm saying that makes sense just in terms of reason, because if a Jew is going to benefit by living the Torah life, 613 commands, so then whoever doesn't benefit from those 613 is having a lesser life. So you see these things again. It's not it's not obligatory, but he's making a very salient point that without the whole system, there's definitely things that are lost. Just like a Jew who's not observant, so he is losing out on the perfections of those other laws. All right, so it's the same for any person who's not keeping them all. That's what he wanted to say on that point.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So, this is a surprising piece of information.
Tell me about it. But I can see it clearly. I see what he's saying.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, I see his point, and then in the other sense, when I, from my limited knowledge of Tanakh, when we look at where the world eventually goes, and it's my understanding that the world will eventually come to an understanding that there is one creator, but we never get a sense, at least I don't think, in any of the prophetic writings, that the world all converts and becomes Jewish. So I'm kind of in my mind trying to reconcile what you just said.
That might be true, but that's not a contradiction.
The same thing that you can kind of, there's a place for both, and this sounds like it's saying, well, sort of there's a place for both, but if you really want to do it right, everyone will convert.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that people are going to use their free will and convert, though. So I don't see a problem. We're just saying in the future, people will recognize the truth, and I'm sure there will be a lot of people that will convert, because it even says in the prophets that the Gentiles would come and to the Jews and tell them to teach them the Torah. So you see that they want to study it. Now, just because in the future, I'm not sure what's going to happen. I don't think any of us do know. I don't think it says anywhere that they will not all convert. It's just that we're assuming that they're not, right? We're assuming that they're not going to. They'll just have some sort of recognition of God, but we don't know that. And second of all, it's not a contradiction to say that the perfection is still there if you do convert. And again, based on reason, you have to say that makes sense, because since human beings are identical, so whatever is going to benefit one must benefit the other. And if you take away some of that perfection in one human being, you have to say that he's not enjoying the perfection that comes from those activities. Reason demands that Rabbi Chait said this, that it makes sense. And I said this also, I mean, during the year, I remember saying this clearly, that there's no obligation, but whoever, you know, a Gentile that definitely practices all the commands is definitely going to benefit from them. He's definitely going to be at a much higher level. Again, there's no obligation.
Okay, I hear you.
Yeah. But again, look at it in terms of two Jews, one who's observant, one who's not. You definitely have to say that the one who's not is gaining less in terms of his perfection. He's not seeing the ideas, he's not involved in study. So he has to definitely be on a lower level. And again, this doesn't mean in any way any one individual is more preferred before God than another. So it shouldn't be looked at that way. that because a Jew is born and he has the obligations, that doesn't automatically make him better than a Gentile who is Noachite. I mean, it's an obligation in order to uphold it for the whole world. Again, that's really to teach everybody. So it shouldn't be looked at as like any inherent value that a person who's Jewish has, because it's the free will of the person to apply to himself ideas and certain practices. Let's see. Okay. All right, so the questions again, just to reiterate. So Moses, according to his Midrashim, looks in the future, and he sees that nobody's going to be good from this Egyptian. So Richard also asked a very good point. And Razor is just asking on the last point, what about the different roles? Yeah, the roles exist because that's how God set up the world. But there definitely is, you know, in terms of there being a role of Jews and the role of Gentiles, I mean, that wasn't even initially due to God. That was due to man. God initially just made Adam and Eve, and the plan was that they would have ideas and teach them to the children, that they would see them, and the world would just be able to, with just a few commands, would be able to live the right life. So that was the original plan. It wasn't until the world deviated with idolatry and then Abraham arose as being the only monotheist that God then gave him a system in order to preserve it for the rest of the world because the world got so corrupt. Now God had to give an increased system that would combat the wrong idolatrous ideas. So that's why Abraham ended up getting a system. If it wasn't for the idolatrous people, you would not have had a system that would combat those idolatrous ideas. If it wasn't for the fact that Egypt and the Canaanites were idolatrous, you would not have laws in the Torah that say don't follow the ways of the Egyptians and the Canaanites. So you have to look at it clearly. There was an initial plan, man deviated, one man arose that was used his mind, and this man was a Gentile, he was not a Jew. And God then gave him a system in order for the whole world that he could teach it. And eventually this is what, you know, God wants that the whole world sees it. So it wasn't because God rejected any of the people, it's because he went around to all the other nations and they did not accept it. The Talmud discusses that. So the Jews are the only ones that actually accepted it. Okay. And it makes sense because God's not interested in favoritism. He created all human beings because he wants the perfection in all human beings. All right. So now... to the Rebbe Chait's question, when he said, is that when it says that Moses looked in the future and he saw that nobody good would come from this Egyptian, so then he smote him. So it's a circular reasoning. Because if he saw that there was nobody coming in the future from this Egyptian, so then how could Moses kill him? By killing him, that means there is no future people. So what was Moses looking at? If he killed him, right? And if Moses did see, on the other hand, if Moses did see the future generations of this Egyptian, so that means he didn't kill the Egyptian. But the facts say that he did kill him. Do you see the question?
I think so. You mean it's like, okay, if I killed him, there wouldn't be anybody there, so how could I look in the future and see anybody there? But if I look ahead and see a whole bunch of people there, then I must not have killed him because they're there.
Exactly. It's just a very sharp, enjoyable observation.
I see.
So, you see that it can't be taken, you know, just at face value. All right. And, okay. And it also says that he, again, it's saying that he's seeing with his wisdom and he's seeing the future. I mean, a human being can't see the future. We talked about this last week. There's no ability to see the future. So what does this mean over here? What is Yonas and Benazir? I mean, again, they're using the verse 2:12, and it says that Moses looked this way and that way, and he saw that there would not be any man. So what does it mean he saw? He saw in the future. Right? That's not the plain reading of the text, but they're using that verse in order to embed a new truth that they saw. Now we'll have to understand what the truth is. So that's one question. What does this mean just in terms of Jonas and Benizia, what he's saying over here? Number two, we had the question about what type of justice is this? If the guy is deserving of death, why do I care that in the future he might have somebody righteous? You know, what type of system of justice is that? Person deserves death. We don't take a guy off of, you know, what do they call that row? Something row?
Death row.
Death row. We don't take him off of death row because we looked at the magic ball. I mean, the guy killed 20 million people, but we're not going to kill him because the magic ball said that he's going to have a grandson that's going to be a righteous person. I mean, what type of righteousness is that? All right, that was another major question. Okay. And also, what does it mean that Moses looked in that house and he looked in the field? I mean, he saw the behavior of this Egyptian, both in the house and in the field, and that's when he killed him. So what does the house and the field have to do? All right. So those are the questions on this one verse. And give you a moment to think about it. And it's interesting, in the very same section, I mean, the Torah, we know the verses and the gaps in the sections are all divinely ordained. So when we see in the Torah that there's no break in the text, that means all the stories that are involved are related. And there's no break in the text of this story of him killing the Egyptian, and it goes on to the fact that Moses flees when he finds out that even the Jews know about what he did, that he killed the Egyptian. Paro finds out, and he wanted to kill Moses, so he has to flee from Egypt. And it says in verse 15 that he dwelled in Midian, the town of Midian, and he sat by the well. And to the priest of Midian, there were seven daughters, and they came and they drew the water from the watering troughs to water the sheep of the father. But then the shepherds came and they drove them away. But Moses was there and he stood up and he saved them, and he also watered their flock. And it says, this was Yisro, who was eventually going to be Moses' father-in-law. But why was he here? Why was Yisro here? Jethro, why was he here? Because he had rejected the idolatrous practices of the other people, so they ostracized him, and he was living in seclusion with his daughters. And Moses saw this, and he respected that, and he stayed with him, and he even watered the sheep of these women. Okay, and this story is following right after the case of killing the Egyptian. So the question is, what's the significance? What is it necessary for us to know about this? And that he stood up and he defended the women and he rewarded their flock. And then it says also that Moses was happy to dwell with the men. That's in 2:21. And then he married Zipporah, who was the daughter of Jethro. And then it says in 22 that he had a son with her, and he called his name Gershom. Why? What does Gershom mean? Ger means a stranger. He says, I have been a stranger in a strange land. But he said this as a praise, and Rabbi Chaib was quoting Rabbi Henoch Bald, who said a very nice explanation on this, and that he was praising God that he had this opportunity to go through a certain experience. So we'll have to see what the experience was. But it had to do with him being a stranger. I mean, he joined with Yisro, who was ostracized because Yisro rejected the masses. But Moses joined him. He stayed with him regardless. So Moses joined in being ostracized as well. So it's interesting. What Jay wanted to say is that, let's take the major question first. And that is that what type of system of justice is this, that because somebody in the future might have certain good seed, that would now defer the punishment from him. So he said there's two things. There's human justice and there's divine justice. In terms of human justice, yes, you have to, follow a certain system. That's what we have. But if you remember when God says to Abraham that, and I'm just bringing this in myself as support to Rabbi Chait, that God told Abraham that, the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah has come to me, and now I will see whether I will destroy them or not. Meaning to say that they are worthy of death, but there may be certain extenuating circumstances. And that's why God says to Abraham at the beginning, am I going to keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do? That means that a certain area of justice Abraham can determine on his own, which he did. But there's a certain area that if God does not inform him, then it will be hidden. There are certain things. I mean, it's only a drop of water in all the seas of the world in terms of the knowledge that we have of what God knows. So whatever Abraham can realize on his own is just it's like a drop in the ocean. So of course the vast majority has to be informed to him. So God tells Abraham that I'm going to go down and see whether they are going to be destroyed. So that means he's hinting to Abraham that there's another consideration why he won't destroy these people. That means outside of their own worthiness, there's other considerations. So this was news to Abraham. So that led him to start thinking, and it brought him his mind to ponder, so there must be some extenuating circumstances. Well, that means that, Abraham up to that point thought that the righteous person is saved and the wicked person is killed. That's it. The wicked person always has to be killed. But now he learned that a wicked person could even be saved too if there's some other circumstances. So that's why he started asking God, if there are a certain number of righteous people, will you stay off the punishment? And God responded, yes. So you see that in terms of man's own sense of justice, a person who is worthy of death has to be killed. But in God's world, he explores all corners. God knows all knowledge. So there, all the considerations are revealed before God. And he was giving this information to Abraham. Why? Because, as it says in the verses over there, in order that Abraham will command his household afterwards in the ways of God to do righteousness and charity. So he wanted Abraham to have this higher level of knowledge that cannot be derived through just studying the world. So he had to communicate that directly to him in order that Abraham's descendants should have this knowledge. So that's what God was doing over here with Moses. He was given a certain prophecy. And that's what it means that Moses looked into the future. You can't look into the future. But if you have prophecy, then you can. Then you know what the future is. And that's exactly what we said this week. The only way you could know what the future holds is if you have prophecy. So God was now revealing to Moses new considerations that this person that you want to kill, right, because you see that the justice demands it, there are other considerations before you can kill him. We have to, in terms of the ultimate system, and the reason God was now telling this to Moses is because he eventually was going to be the leader of the Jews, just like Abraham was going to be a leader. So God wanted them to have the highest level of knowledge attainable by man. So God gave knowledge to Moses just like he gave knowledge to Abraham. And he told them that in the future there is not going to be anybody who's going to convert or will do repentance. Teaching Moses thereby that this is a consideration before me when I make any decisions, Moses. That's what God was telling to Moses. Man has a system, and without being divinely inspired, he has to weigh all the facts that he sees, and that's all he has, is what his mind tells him. But God wanted to now give Moses a higher level, because to lead the people, he wanted to give him the highest level knowledge possible. Okay, so that's what it means. It says that he looked and he pondered. And you see also that, as Rabbi Chait said, it's not simply that when you get a prophecy, that's it. There's no interaction. No, you think into it, and you analyze it, because prophecy is a form of knowledge. And any knowledge of God, you could penetrate further. So that's what it means, that he looked, he saw the prophecy, but then he used his intelligence, his chachma, his wisdom, And he pondered every generation, and God showed to him before him, and he taught him that there is nothing that can ever eventually come out. Now, why was it so impossible that something could eventually come out of this person? So that's where this, the Rashi is, where it says that Moses looked at this, the house and the field. Meaning Moses was a great chacham. He was a great intellect. And he saw that the way this Egyptian behaved in his house was different than the way he behaved in the field. Meaning that this Egyptian really, why was he beating up on this one Jew? It's because this Egyptian, when the Jew was working during the day, went and had intercourse with this Jew's wife. And it bothered him. But what bothered him about it? It bothered him that it would become revealed. So when he was in his house alone, and Moses saw the way this Egyptian was at ease, but then when he saw the Egyptian in public, in the field, and he saw how he was beating up on this Jew, meaning he was trying to repress this from getting out. He was hitting the Jew so the news wouldn't get out. So that means that the reality of this Egyptian, in his mind, he didn't care about the fact that he sinned against God. He cared only that other people would find out. So Moses saw that the sense of reality that this Egyptian lives by has nothing to do with the true reality of whether you go against God. The only reality this Egyptian had was whether I'm going to be found out or not. Ego. So Moses saw that, and he saw that this is the level of this person, that he's completely divorced from any semblance of truth. He said it'll be impossible that any good individual can come from here. There's too much of a deviance from reality. Okay, and I'm not sure if Rabbi Chait said that this was in accompaniment with knowledge that God gave him through prophecy, or just something that Moses saw on his own, but this complements that idea. All right, so we see why the Rashi says that Moses saw the Egyptian in his house when he was at ease, but also in the field when he was beating up, because in the field is when things are public, and this Jew can now say something to other people. So that is the inconsistency in this Egyptian's activity, showed that he lived based on just this concern for his ego, and not in terms, he didn't care at all that he did a sin, that he ruined the life of this woman and this man. Okay. Now let me just pause here, see if there's any comments or questions.
So the sages then derived that the Egyptian was essentially assaulting the wife of the Jew, and he was very free and easy about it when he wasn't in public, but was very concerned that it not get out publicly, and that's why he's beating up the Jew.
That's right.
Okay. Wow.
I mean, they're trying to explain in that Rashi, they're trying to explain some credit to Moses' observation of this Egyptian. What did he see that really discredited him from having any potential offspring that would be good individuals? So they said it must be that there was such a deviant nature in this Egyptian that he did not partake of anything in reality whatsoever. His whole, he was totally consumed with just his own, his reputation, not in terms of sinning against God. Nice idea. Okay. Now, let me just see if I covered the... All right, so we answer the question now, because we don't really... See, the person really is, you know, worthy of death in terms of our system, but that's why looking into the future is something God teaches Moses, that there are other considerations that are much broader than man's scope. And in God's system, every single factor in the universe is weighed. That's what it means, that he looked into the future. He showed Moses the future. Would there be any type of, would this disrupt any type of potential individual? And Rabbi Chait also said, he quoted another source, I forget where, that certain individuals were brought into the world because they would be progenitors of great people. So you see that God works on a scale that spans all of time. We just live in the moment. So that statement also shows you that you know, God's considerations consider everything, not just even at the moment, but everything from beginning to the end of time. All right, so that's a very good support, that second quote. That people are brought into existence because they will be progenitors of great people. So that means that their existence is really, the worth of their existence is not measured merely by themselves. You see?
Yes, but I thought that every person was judged on the basis of their own actions.
Yes, that's true. And somebody actually asked that question. They were quoting Ishmael, that the God was saving him from thirst. So somebody had asked that question in the class today. And the person quoted, he says, well, you look at, take a look at Ishmael, and he was saved, even though in the future his descendants would be harassing the Jews and killing the Jews. So the response that God gave, and this was the metaphorically the angel speaking to God, saying, how could you save him and give water to this person who's who's going to be the progenitor of evil people? So God said to the angels, well, what is he now? Is Ishmael righteous now, or is he wicked? So the angel says, he's righteous right now. So God says, so I'm judging him right based on now. So Rav Chait said a very good answer, that in terms of righteousness, so right now he doesn't deserve any punishment, Ishmael. So you can't inflict an injustice on a righteous person because in the future he's going to sin, or in the future his children are going to sin. That you can't do. So that's why he was spared. But the opposite is not true. If you have somebody who's wicked right now, so although he should be punished, but God inclines towards being charitable. And he said, and even we have to copy God's ways. That's why it says, V'hitzilu ha'eda, Rabbi Chait quoted, there's an injunction from the Torah that the court should always look for merit when they judge a case. They should not look for accusative grounds. They should always look for some way out, some way to acquit. So, in terms of when somebody's righteous and they didn't sin yet, of course God's not going to kill them because of the future. What did they do wrong? But in terms of somebody who sins, God's righteousness can step in and be charitable and you know, stay the execution if there are other considerations. All right? That answers the question.
Well, but then doesn't that bring us around to the case of the Egyptian? I mean, if...
Why? He was guilty of death?
For his current actions?
Yes. He was beating up a Jew. It's actually the Noahide laws that Rabbi Chait quoted, that the Gentile who's raising, and that's where they derive it from, is right, that case. A Gentile raises his hand to hit a Jew, so he is punishable by death. It's just that the courts don't carry it out, but it's something which that status has devolved upon him now. He is now worthy of death.
Do you recall which of the laws that falls under?
Not offhand, but I did see, you know, I was reading an introduction to the Talmud last night, I think it was Rabbeinu Nissen, and he talks about how he's quoting there's about 30 or more Noahide laws. So we didn't even cover that many yet when we were doing Sanhedrin. So I'm not sure. There could be areas that we just haven't touched on yet.
Okay.
Maybe it's a subset of killing him. I mean, that would be the first thing I would think of. Okay. So what we're saying that yes, he was worthy of death at that point, but he was stayed. He was the execution was stayed. And we said, what was the trend of thought I was just saying? Is there something else I wanted to mention? What was the last point we were saying, Doug?
We were asking about the law and which law that would fall under the Noahide if he raises his hand against a Jew is liable to...
Right, before that.
I was asking about the question of taking into account all the actions that happened, and you said that the Egyptian was liable.
Right.
So I guess I wanted Well, I'll let you finish your thought.
No, I lost it. It'll come back to me, hopefully. Go ahead. What was your question?
Well, my question then was, did Rabbi Tate make it clear whether, is the Egyptian liable for debt because he raised his hand against a Jew? And it sounds like the answer is yes. Or because it sounds like he raped the Jew's wife.
It could be both.
Okay.
It would seem to be both.
And do we know how they derived that the Egyptian did that?
He didn't go into that.
Okay.
That was also brought down in the Rashi, I believe. But that they accept as a fact, and they even say they identify the actual person who it was. So it seems to be that they had that fact. That was known.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Right. Let's see. Okay, so now the second story about Moses and going to the well and saving the Yithro's daughters and dwelling with him. So this comes on the heels of this story. So Rabbi Shea wanted to understand what was the concept there. So he mentioned that here it showed that Moses was able to side with the person that was being ostracized, because he lived by truth. And this was important. He said, actually, there were two things necessary before Moses got the vision at the burning bush. There were these two events. One event was that he had to now raise his level of understanding in terms of when he's a leader has to apply the best justice. And Rabbi Chaik explained that it's true that we have a Shulchan Aruch, we have a system of laws, but that's just in terms of how we have to, the forced activity that we must do in order to keep, things functioning properly. But you should always try to not have to resort to being told what to do. For example, if you have a quarrel with somebody on money, you try to work out a compromise between the two of you in order that you can reach a higher level of functioning where you're not forced by a ruling of a judge, but that you can work it out yourselves, which is called a compromise, pshara, as we say in Hebrew. So that's really the highest level when you don't have to. But, the system of keeping the laws is not where we're supposed to just be all and end all, but then we're supposed to arrive at higher understanding. And similarly, the verses and just the plain reading of the Torah, that's, the Torah has to be written on levels for all people. But that's not where we should end. We should try to see further truths. So this concept of God imparting to Moses a level of justice that was higher than the human sphere, attains on its own, is to show you that that was necessary for Moses in terms of a leader to have the highest level knowledge that he could now impart. So that was one step in terms of preparing Moses in terms of a leader. Another is that a leader necessarily has to be able to be convinced of his position and stay firm and be following the truth. So that came about when he took a stand with Yisro, who denounced idolatry and was ostracized. Nonetheless, Moses stayed with Yisro, and he then said that this was something which he reflected on himself, and he saw that this was a very good thing for him to go through, because it gave him that ability to express the conviction and truth, as opposed to wanting to just follow the masses. And that was something which he respected, and he praised God by naming his son by that name, that I was a stranger in this land, meaning this was a good thing. It was a praise to God that now being a stranger here is something which I benefited from. It allowed me to express a conviction in truth more than the need to be accepted. And that's necessary for a leader, that the leader should not be looking for acceptance. A leader should be telling the truth. So this was a second step in the development, which was Rabbi Chait was saying, and that's exactly what the sequence is now in the Torah. You could look at these two stories as independent stories, or you could see them as being necessary right before he gets the vision. Right, and that's what comes up next, the vision. So, so it's nice that Rabbi Chait put it together and show that when the rabbis are giving these midrashim, when they see some nuance in the verse, or they see something, they see a sequence in the stories, and they want to explain what's going on. So they'll look for something to tack on their ideas to, but they will think into it themselves. They'll write the Medrash down, and it doesn't seem to be they're getting it from anywhere but their own intelligence. And they use their own intelligence to derive, what is God telling us more in the Torah here? There's so much below the surface. What's the sequence? What's the reason why these two verses come one after the other? What's the use of this interesting type of a word over here? And all these different clues that they started recognizing are generous hints from God to unravel deeper knowledge from the story. So it was quite an eye-opening class that I gave today. And again, on the theme that we were discussing of how to you take a look at the verses. So we were talking about when we're looking at the verses and certain coincidences of Moses, he went down by the water, and then the daughter of Pharaoh went down there, and she extended her hand, and it was the timing was an issue. Here, it's the sequence of one story following another, and also the words that the Torah is telling you, that Moses looked this way, and he looked that way. Oh, that's interesting. It's a unique type of a phraseology. The rabbis picked up on that, and saw this as being a hint that God was giving us in his Torah, you know, to see greater ideas. So on what we're discussing, the sensitivity that we have to have is to the reading of the verse, the sequence of the stories, the sequence of the verses. And when we look in Rashi, and we look at Yonos and Ben Uziel, we look at any of the great rabbis, and we see them taking off on a certain point, like Rabbi Chait did today a number of times. He asked the question, what was bothering Yonos and Ben Uziel? What was bothering Rashi, right? That they had to say something over here. And we had mentioned that also. What we have to get into their mind of it and think, what was bothering these rabbis that they now had to spend ink and write something over here? What was the question that they're responding to? And the more we do that, the more we increase our sensitivity, the greater amount of knowledge we will be able to derive, because we're increasing our understanding of how the clues work in terms of the Chumash. Okay, let me pause here. Go ahead. Any questions?
You know, Rabbi, this makes me think how on the surface, if you look at that, you know, he looked this way and that, you would just think, well, he's probably just seeing what anybody see what it is he intends to do to the Egyptian because he doesn't want to get caught.
Right.
But if every action that you do in life, you also recognize that there's a higher authority, that's God, that is also seeing your actions. And in this, probably, I mean, to me, I see the connection of then prophecy in the sense that you need to see beyond your physical situation here. To determine what's right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense? I mean, we don't have the ability, most of us don't have the ability to see prophecy, but when we recognize that there is a God that sees everything we do, then it makes us more responsible or ultimately responsible to God than just to our physical surroundings.
Right, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and God was imparting to Moses a higher level here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you see that, Abraham, it says that as well, that he gave him that information because he was going to, as Rabbi Chait said, he was going to go in the way of God. So the way of God means not the way of man. It means a higher level. So God gave Abraham. It's nice when you see corroboration right in the Torah that this was done previously. And Moses saw this as well, that he was aware of what happened to Abraham, and he had these transmissions, and coming from the house of Levi, so they were allowed to be involved in study, and Levi being the son of Jacob, and Jacob being the grandson of Abraham, so this was all passed down. So it's a whole different take on what this story is about. You see, God says to Abraham, am I going to keep hidden from Abraham what I will do? And he's going to be a great nation and mighty. And he's going to teach his household to follow the ways of God. Meaning, there is the ways of man, the best that man can go, but there's the ways of God. So that's why God says, will I keep hidden? Meaning, it will be hidden unless I tell Abraham that there's other considerations. Normally, a righteous person is saved and the wicked person is destroyed. But I can now teach Abraham that there are other considerations, that I look at more than just the momentary thing in a myopic view of a certain town. I look at from one generation to the next, from the beginning of the world to the end, everything involved, all considerations are before me. And this is what he wanted to give to Abraham, and this is what he gave to Moses over here. Both of them being leaders, both passing on the greatest knowledge of God. That's what God wants, is that man should have the highest level of knowledge. So that means that we have to have prophecy. And that's exactly what God was giving Moses here. The areas of knowledge that we have is a drop in the ocean. What we need is the Torah, which is a prophetic work, to teach us all the areas that we just cannot tap on our own. Even in Abraham, couldn't tap these things on his own. And you see Moses as well, the greatest prophet ever. All right, any other questions or comments?
I think we're good.
Okay. All right. All right. Okay, so I guess we'll wrap it up here. This Sunday I will be here. Following Sunday I will not. So we'll pick up this Sunday at 11:15.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right then.
Thank you, Rabbi. Very interesting.
Okay. Yeah, enjoyed it.
Okay, it's Rabbi Chait, not me. I'm just repeating over what I just heard. But have a good day off, and we'll pick up on Sunday.
All right, you too. Thanks so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye.
Okay, so that's going to wrap it up for today. We'll pick up on Sunday at 11:15 New York time. I hope everybody has a good day off and a good week. Take care.